Back in the USSR, I'll be back after this short break.
If you're looking for power, you certainly come to the right place because you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. 250 watts of community power.
Each year in Guelph, approximately 99 teen pregnancies occur between women aged 15 to 19. Since 1983, the YMCA-YWCA of Guelph has offered a free program that offers a safe, non-judgmental place where pregnant and parenting teen mothers and fathers can belong and grow as parents. This program provides support, information, and resources to pregnant and parenting teens between the ages of 14 and 21. Fathers can be 24 years of age or younger. TAPS is a free ongoing program meeting weekly on Mondays and Thursdays between 4 and 7 p.m. and is designed to provide information on topics including but not limited to child development, nutrition, managing stress, birth control, budgeting, healthy relationships, and behavior management. For more information on TAPS, please visit guelphy.org or contact Sarah Robb, Teenage Parents Program Coordinator, at 519-821-3900 or Sarah Robb, that's S-A-R-A-H-R-O-B-B, at guelphy.org.
Close to Home. An eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM, Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll even play that different Canadian song that you won't hear anywhere else on the radio. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
Hi, I'm Handel, and I volunteer at CFRU because I love working with the people here, and I also love the feeling of contributing something meaningful to the world.
CFRU is always looking for new volunteers. No experience is necessary, and all the training is free. If you would like to get involved, email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Hi, my name is Jeff, and I love CFRU because it introduces me to all kinds of music I would otherwise not have heard. And there's a vending machine down the hall.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So before the break, we heard from Natalie Merchant with Which Side Are You On? And we heard from Gerald Horn, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. That was the talk which he gave about his book on the Real News Network. He wrote, of course, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. Understanding the class forces really behind the and the race relations behind the American Revolution, and understanding that ultimately it was a revolt of rich plantation owners and like slave owners and the merchants who trafficked in slaves, basically trying to basically serve their own profit motive by rebelling against the British Empire. And that was really the foundation of the American Revolution. And it was not a pretty thing. So, and before then, of course, we had Nine Inch Nails with the Hand That Feeds. Talk a little bit about the last song which I played, though, Natalie Merchant with Which Side Are You On? Because basically, it's a matter of historical record. I mean, Tim Wise talked a little bit about this. I mean, there were rebellions in the American colonies in the early, in the 17th century, where you actually had African slaves and bonded laborers, mostly of Irish background, joining forces in rebellion against the rich planters, against the slaveocracy in Virginia and other colonies in the colonies that would become the United States. And there was like this combined interest, the shared interest that they had. You know, both of these people, both of them are in chains, both of them are suffering. Maybe at that, you know, even though you had, because of course, like the Irish, it's very interesting. I'm actually reading right now the Theodore W. Allen's book, The Invention of the White Race, where he talks about three different peoples who were denigrated and experienced racism under the British Empire in its early years, its early centuries. And those were Indigenous Americans, Black Africans, and Irish people. All of them were called savages. All of them were called unfit for civilization. All of them were called, you know, were basically fit for only for servitude or to be destroyed, broken down, purged from the landscape, and their place taken by the rightful Anglo-Saxon settlers, you could say. So all these different people had basically a common interest to begin with against the British Empire in the 17th century, you know, in the colonies of what became the United States. But what ultimately happened, of course, to the Irish component to that triad right there, which I just told you about, what happened to the Irish people? They were the ones ultimately who were co-opted by the system. They were the ones who were granted some concessions by the slaveocracy to prevent them from rebelling, to prevent them from standing in solidarity with African slaves. And they were the ones who were maybe given a small bit of land, though by the American Revolution, most of the white people in the Virginia colony still were landless. At least half of them still had no land. So ultimately that was kind of facile, the idea that all of them got land. But all of them were privileged under the law. All of them were given a leg up, given privileges that Africans did not have. In fact, Africans basically were removed from having any standing under the law whatsoever. They were permanently enslaved, permanently beaten down, permanently consigned to an underclass of slaves. Meanwhile, you had, at least on paper, poor white people being privileged, being given a leg up. Some of those people got material benefits as well, but many of them did not. But still, they were placed in an elevated position by the law. They were co-opted by the system. And if you want to look at the struggle against slavery as really the founding labor struggle in North American history, the workers of European descent in the 17th century and 18th century chose the wrong side. They were on the wrong side. They sided with the plantation owners, the slavers, the rich merchants who were profiting from the slave trade. They sided with the ruling class in the colonies, you know, and assisted in the suppression of African resistance and indigenous resistance. And that had long-standing repercussions. It still has repercussions to this day with how North American society is divided, how the working class in North America is divided, and how basically the ruling elite has gotten working class people to oppress one another along racial lines and prevented them from uniting against their common enemy. You know, this was an absolute boon, especially when it came to the organization of the labor movement in North America, like in the 19th and 20th century, where you had, you know, the bosses took advantage of racial divides amongst the working people. I mean, they would, you know, deliberately bring in, you know, when workers were on strike, when white workers were on strike, they would deliberately bring in scabs who were people of color to try to break strikes, to create racial animosity between working people, to prevent them from working together. And they would use this kind of psychological kind of control mechanism based on race. And that is why racism is so valuable to capitalists, just as it was valuable to slave owners and to feudal lords, for that matter, like this sort of thing. You know, dividing people along racial lines, religious lines, sectarian lines, what have you, is the standard procedure for ruling classes around the world. And it's how they maintain control. And that certainly is the case in North America, where you see race relations to this day, how that's been used to benefit the ruling class at the expense of working people who cannot unite and are continually, you know, at each other's throats, you know, white people continuing to oppress black people and see them as the threat, when, of course, really the real enemy is, of course, the ruling class. Now, I want to, of course, understand that this has to do with imperialism. Imperialism is the common theme here. And if white people don't understand empire, if they don't understand imperialism, they can't understand whiteness. And if they don't understand whiteness, they can't understand what black and brown and indigenous people are dealing with. And if they don't understand that, they can't wrap their heads around any of this. You know, imperialism is the lightning bolt, as the ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, that strikes its root through everything. And in the end, imperialism cannot be understood without understanding class. So this all ties together in the end. And this is very important to understand. You know, and white people have traditionally been, say, the foot soldiers of imperialism. It was white people who were used as the soldiers, as the militia in the destruction of indigenous societies in North America, the genocidal extermination that was waged against indigenous people in North America. White people were used as foot soldiers in the, you know, in imperialist wars, you know, all the way from the conquest of India to the conquest of Vietnam in the 20th century. And like, you know, and even now, like with Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that, it's white people who have traditionally been the most dependable servants of the ruling class, you know, who you can count on to volunteer for the military, you know, be police officers, you know, be, you know, effective public servants and perpetuate the system. Or at least not condemn the system, or if you actually mobilize against the system, you know, to be able to be co-opted by the language of race. You know, all this stuff. You know, so that's how imperialism makes use of people in different ways. Imperialism doesn't hinge on skin color, but on profitability and power, and how best to exploit and control the victims of imperialism. And that's really the root of racism. Racism hinges on how the ruling class can control, how can best control working people. Racism is a tool. A tool to enforce certain class interests in society. That's really why it exists. You know, and of course, this is why I say, of course, like to white people, you know, when we understand our place in this system, this decadent racist society, as Bobby Seale described it, Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party, you know, when we understand that we historically have been enforcers for this system, you know, kept slavery going, kept empire going, you know, kept really the entire capitalist edifice going around the world, spread it around the world, enforced it around the world, imposed it on other peoples around the world. You know, and we're given certain carrots, privileges, you know, crumbs from the ruling class's table and as a reward. That's really what we have to understand when we look ourselves in the mirror each day. When we understand who we are and what we are, and what we have to do if we want to change things. And we have to change. We have to stop facilitating the oppression of others. We have to stop being compliant tools of the ruling elite. And the only way to do this is to break down the imperialist structure that has historically co-opted us and used us as its weapons, as its tools of coercion against other people. We have to refuse to be tools, basically. Refuse to be weapons. And that means a lot of things. You know, it means refusing to go along with imperialism. It means refusing to serve in the military. It means understanding why a movie like The Interview is so grotesque, where it portrays the assassination of the leader of a foreign state, and why buying the propaganda on North Korea is so toxic. You know, the idea that this country is crazy and, you know, it's perfectly justified to work to overthrow it and destroy that society. You know, that mentality, that very imperialist mentality, is very deeply rooted in Western society, and basically it's rooted in white people. Because we've more or less always been taught that empire is justified. That it's somehow a civilizing force. You know, and that these people out there in the world, these so-called lesser people, they need the empire to civilize themselves or something like that. I mean, we have to, like, bring civilization to them or some, you know, really messed up racist ideology like that. You know, this is the kind of thing that really has historically made us so dangerous as white people. So as we go into the 21st century, we see how the United States is increasingly upping the rhetoric against places like China and Russia and Iran and all these countries which are engaged in peaceful economic development, who are increasingly integrating their economies together, you know, building the new Silk Road as China is doing. You know, integrating the economies of Central Asia. And they do it peacefully. They don't want a confrontation with the West. They're not, like, trying to destroy the West. They're not they don't want to antagonize the West. They just want to develop themselves. And that precisely is what is threatening to the United States right now, to the American empire. Remember, America is an empire. It's trying to maintain its hegemonic control over the world. and the rise of China, the integration of China, Russia, India, Iran, in economic terms, being able to develop their own countries themselves without the IMF, without the World Bank, without the U.S. multinational corporations, without any of that. That is a very threatening thing to the empire. And that's where we're seeing conflict emerge in the 21st century. And so much of it hinges on imperialism, really European imperialism. This entire conflict has its roots in European imperialism. And the desire of that, the inheritor of European imperialism, namely the United States, to maintain its control. You know, and the ruling class in the United States to maintain its control and maintain its profits. You know, so this is very relevant today on a not only on an internal North American society level, but like on a, you know, geopolitical level. And this is why it's very important for white people not to go along. With the ruling elite in the West and what it has planned and what it wants to do and what its interests are. There has to be refusal. There has to be mutiny. We have to refuse to play their game. And only then can we really effectively stand in solidarity with black and brown people and indigenous people. We can't accept, we cannot continue to accept this racist, this decadent racist society as normal. We have to understand it for the monstrosity that it is. And we have to resist it. And this is very important to understand. It's very, very important for white people to understand. Because we've historically had the most amount of trouble understanding it. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Children cry, oh, I just got away. I look to the east, I look to the west, to the north and the south, and I'm not too impressed. Time after crime after crime, they rape, rob, pillage, enslaved and murdered. Jesus Christ was their God, and they done it in his name, so he could take the blame if it's not all a game. With Bible in one hand and a sword in the other, they came to purify my land and my Gaelic Irish mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers. With our own ancient customs, laws, music, art, way of life and culture, tribal and structure. We had a civilization, but they were still not under our nations. We suffer with the Native American, the Indian in Asia, Aboriginal Australia, the African people with their history so deep. And our children still weep, and our lives are still cheap. You came from Germany, from France, from England and from Spain, from Belgium and from Portugal, you are the much the same. You took what was not yours, went against your own Bible. You broke your own laws just to outdo the rival. But did you ever apologize for the hundreds of millions of lives you destroyed and terrorized? Or have you never realized? Did you never feel shame for what was done in your country's name? Now who's to blame? I'm worried about so inhumane. I'm still to teach you in your school about those glorious days of rule and how it's your destiny to be superior to me. But if you've any kind of mind, you'll see that all humankind are the children of this earth, and your hate for them will chew you up and spit you out.
Welcome back to the Real News Network. This is Reality Asserts Itself, and I'm Paul J. in Baltimore. We're continuing our discussion with Gerald Horn, who now joins us in the studio. Gerald is the author of, most recently, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA, and that's what we're talking about. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
So we're going to move into around the 1730s. Spain still has what's known as Spanish Florida. And as the Spains are allying with the Africans, both in the Caribbean and appealing to Africans in the slave colonies to come and help fight against this slavery and become kind of allies in the Spanish-British fight. Mm-hmm. And this gives rise to something called Georgia. Tell us this story.
Well, Britain was faced with a dilemma. That is to say that it perhaps is not accidental that the term that was used for Africans, that is to say negros or negros, was the Spanish word for black, which tend to suggest a reality, which is that the Africans were seen as a natural ally of the Spanish. Not least because, as noted, the Spanish were quite willing to arm the Africans, the free Negro population, or the free African population, so-called, in Spanish Florida and in Spanish Cuba, dwarfed its counterpart on the North American mainland, in Virginia, the Carolinas, etc. So
just as an extension of Spanish English rivalry in various places.
Yes. So the idea was that Britain was basically providing the rope with which to hang itself by continuing to import Africans. That was like continuing to import allies of Spain. So the idea was perhaps you could do an end run around that dilemma by forming a so-called all-white colony, which was how Georgia got started. The state of Georgia in the present-day United States of America started in the 1730s as a so-called all-white project. The problem there was that many of those who were defined as white found it easier than Africans to escape to freedom in South Carolina because of their phenotype and the fact that they're, quote, white, unquote. And also the idea was...
What did you say, escape? This all-white colony.
So you had,
they didn't have white slaves, did they?
Well, no. But they were working in the fields.
Right, as laborers.
As laborers. But if they wanted to improve their standard of living, sometimes they felt that it would be better to go to Charleston or to New York even, and you'd have a better shot at a better livelihood. And also it was felt that by putting those defined as white in the fields, that you were recreating the class contradictions of Europe and leading to so-called white-on-white violence.
Well, how do you create this whiteness and this bond that's supposed to transcend class? Because we're all white and we're supreme and we're better than these dehumanized blacks. Well, how do you do that if, as you say, all of a sudden you have white laborers in the fields?
Right, exactly. It didn't work out very well. So, and then of course, you had the typically maniacal slave dealers who began to flood Georgia almost from day one with enslaved Africans because it was such a profitable enterprise. And so that was defeating the whole idea of a so-called white colony, defeating it to the point where the 2010 census in the USA suggested that Georgia has the largest number of black people in the USA right now. So to show you how that project was defeated. But it raises other questions too, which is this whole question of whiteness. And it seems to me that this is part of the uniqueness of the USA, which is that the boundaries of whiteness have been elasticized. That is to say that it's not just those from the British Isles who became white when they crossed the Atlantic. It's not just that those who were warring on the shores of Europe, English versus Irish, English versus Scots, Germans versus British, etc., somehow they're magically transformed into being a unitary white when they crossed the Atlantic. It's not just that those with roots from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ural Mountains in Russia are defined as white once they cross the Atlantic. It's the fact that even, say, Steve Jobs of Apple, it was of Syrian descent. Victor Attia, the former, just recently deceased governor of Oregon, of Syrian descent. Ralph Nader, of Lebanese descent. Marlo Thomas, the entertainer, of Lebanese descent. So the boundaries of whiteness were expanded, which obviously helps to bolster the settler project because you can draw upon so many different individuals to come to these shores. And that was needed because in so many different precincts and districts, not least in the South, the European settlers were outnumbered by the Africans and the indigenous population. And so they had the memory of the Caribbean, Antigua, Jamaica, Barbados, where all these outnumbered Europeans were being overrun by Africans. And so by expanding the base of whiteness, they're helping to stabilize the settler project.
And you're taking people who have come, many of them, where they have been themselves part of the oppressed classes, persecuted classes, and now you get here, if you're part of the whiteness, oh, now I'm getting a taste of being in the elite.
right. Or you have the potential
to rise.
At least
I'm better than
they are. Oh, yeah, exactly. You're better than they are, which is something of an incentive, and then there's the possibility of rising on the class ladder. And as we well know, this is nothing unique to the United States. I mean, for example, it's well known that those who had suffered in the Netherlands, Dutch, they came to South Africa and became oppressors. Many of the Irish, when they become Irish Americans.
And it's people often don't know or forget the really first slaves of the English were the Irish.
Right.
So they had their own history of being enslaved.
So, I mean, people could even point to Gaza as we speak, where those who had been suffering in Europe, they come to Arab territory and many of them, some of them, become oppressors. This is nothing unique. This is nothing new. But I think that it's important to talk about in terms of the United States of America, given the propagandist history, as to use the term that Du Bois employed, that has infected the basic narrative of the U.S. story, which is very uplifting, very glorious, and tends to sweep under the rug the rather unpleasant corners, such as what happened to the indigenous population, what happened to the African population, and who they sided with.
So you've got this slave system, which is enormously profitable, and within it, there are all the seeds of its own destruction. So talk a bit about the Stonewall Uprising.
Well, in the late 1730s in South Carolina, you had a major uprising, one of the bloodiest uprisings in mainland North American history, a slave uprising. Interestingly enough, a disproportionate number of these enslaved Africans had roots in Angola, which suggested, number one, that they were influenced by the Roman Catholic religion, Catholicism. Angola was a former Portuguese colony. This is taking place in the context of a religious war between Protestant Britain and the so-called Catholic powers, Spain and France. Speaking of France, many of these Africans spoke Portuguese, which is not altogether dissimilar from the Spanish language. When they revolted in South Carolina, many of them were trying to march to Spanish Florida, because the Spanish had been sending emissaries from St. Augustine, Florida, on the northeast coast of Florida to this very day, who were feeding propaganda to the enslaved, which is to say that if you revolt against the British and cut their throats and find your way to St. Augustine, you can become part of the free Negro class, which seemed like a very good deal. And that's what they were trying to do. I should also mention that during this time, that the British were jousting with the Spanish, not only in Spanish Florida and South Carolina, but in Cartagena and what is now Colombia. That is to say, a very important battle took place around the same time as the Stonewall Uprising, which was, of course, was the late 1730s, where the Spanish were able to best the British because the Spanish employed legions of armed Africans. This was putting enormous pressure on the British to act similarly, not least because the British were conscripting European settlers from the colonies, from Massachusetts to Georgia, to come fight in South America. They didn't want to fight in South America. They were too busy dispossessing the Native Americans. And then the British made another strategic mistake when they were trying to mix together battalions that included conscripted European settlers and armed Africans, and then suggesting that the Africans could share in the booty of war, which is actually what war is all about, just plunder and pillage and take things. And this was outraging the settlers because they had this complaint that ploy of the British helped to fuel, which is they were being treated like Africans, or treated like slaves, as they would often say. In a sense, they were, because the British would often say that the Africans just could share the booty equally with the conscripted European settlers. So the British, seemingly almost in an unwitting fashion, were creating this volcano of unrest amongst European settlers that detonated on July 4th, 1776.
So the uprising, what happened to it?
In Stonewall's Rebellion? Oh, well, what happened is that the Africans massacred a number of European settlers in the dozens.
Where was this exactly?
It's not that far from Charleston, South Carolina. But the Africans themselves wound up being massacred because militias were hastily banded together and they were organized sufficiently to best the Africans on the battlefield.
So in the late 1750s, everything changes.
You are correct. What happens is the Seven Years' War, so-called, 1756 to 1763. Finally, both London and the settlers have had it up to their necks with the Spanish and the French. So London launches a war that ultimately leads to ousting the Spanish from Florida and the French from Quebec. This is a turning point for the Africans in particular because they had relied upon their alliances with the Spanish in Florida and the French in Quebec to bedevil these British settlers from Massachusetts down to Georgia. But now those rear bases have been eliminated. But this also has consequences for London because now we enter the traditional narrative, which is that London wants to exact taxes on the settlers, because after all, this war was for their benefit. But the settlers were not interested in paying taxes, or were not willing to pay taxes, and this adds more fuel to the fire of their incipient revolt. I should also mention that in 1762, in the midst of this war, the British are able to temporarily oust the Spanish from Cuba. Cuba, in many ways, is a treasure trove of riches throughout the history of Spanish colonialism. It was quite a coup for Britain to take over Cuba in 1762 temporarily. Eventually, they wound up trading Cuba back to the Spain for various emoluments. But the problem there for London was that the settlers felt, to coin a phrase, that Cuba was underslaved. That is to say that a hefty bounty could be obtained by going to Africa and bringing Africans to Cuba to be enslaved. In other words, more free trade in Africans. But the British, who I guess you could consider liberals in the sense that they felt that the African slave trade should be tightly regulated, did not want to open up Cuba to free trade in Africans. This was yet another bone of contention between the settlers and Britain, adding more fuel to the fire of their revolt, this question of slavery and the slave trade. Ultimately, what happens is that the embittered Spanish and the embittered French then seek and obtain revenge against London by allying with the settlers to oust Britain from what is now the United States, because it's clear that the settlers could not have won their war against this major military power that was London without ample assistance from the French and the Spanish. It's well known that in some of the key battles of the so-called Revolutionary War, the fall of 1776, French troops were involved. Not only French troops, but French troops from Haiti. That is to say, black troops from Haiti. For example, in the Battle of Savannah during the so-called Revolutionary War. Which makes ironic, if I may say so myself, the fact that during my lifetime, a bone of contention between the United States and Cuba was the fact that Cuban troops were in Angola after Angolan independence in 1976, and this was seen as a violation of the rules of war, international law, etc., when the U.S. itself could not have won its independence without the assistance of foreign troops, not least from France.
It's a little bit of a segue, but talk more about the Cuban-American connection on the slave trade, because you have a whole other book on this.
Yes, right. That's
and,
right.
And it's an important part of this whole story.
Well, part of the whole other book, and don't worry, I'm not going to go into too much detail about it, is that Cuba has been a burr under the saddle of Uncle Sam, not only since January 1959, when Fidel Castro surged to power. Going back to the 17th century, as already noted, Spanish Cuba had been deploying armed Africans to bedevil, pillage, and plunder mainland British settlements from Virginia down to Georgia. You might even be able to argue that there's some sort of repressed memory syndrome still operative in the United States, with this memory that's now been repressed of armed Africans from Cuba coming over to bedevil these settlers. But what's curious, and it seems to me, is something that defenders of the glorious uplifting narrative about the founding of the United States needs to answer, is why is it that this glorious revolution that supposedly took place in 1776 led to the United States, the newly minted United States, basically taking over the slave trade to Cuba shortly after the founding of the United States? One of the reasons you have so many black people in Cuba is because of the manic energy of U.S. slave dealers. I published a book a few years ago about the slave trade to Brazil, which has the largest African population this side of Nigeria.
And most of the slaves from Africa went to Brazil.
Correct. And what's little known is that most of those Africans who were transported across the Atlantic in chains were transported on ships that flew the U.S. flag, the Stars and Stripes, particularly in the 1830s forward. So how do you reconcile the fact of an uplifting, glorious revolt against British rule when the resultant country surges into the leadership of the African slave trade, one of the most onerous episodes in human history. Something doesn't jive here.
So Africans lose their ally in Quebec, French allies in Quebec. They lose the Spanish allies in Florida. There's no easy place to go. So what happens?
It's bad news. I mean, it's shortly thereafter, the so-called Revolutionary War erupts. The Africans decide to ally with the Union Jack, with the British, which is totally understandable because they thought they would get a better deal. But this is not accepted happily by the settlers, who are not only in revolt against British rule, but already, per their Declaration of Independence, have enacted this glorious story about how this is a struggle for liberty and freedom and democracy and human rights, etc.
Well, to some extent, wasn't it also that? What I mean by that, if you look at slave society in Rome or Greek slave society, clearly it was not any great advance for the slaves.
Mm.
But for the rest of the society, you could say it was some kind of a step forward. Was the American Revolution not also that?
2 points. One, I concede that the revolt against British rule was a step forward insofar as it toppled monarchy. But we shouldn't stop there. That is to say, you have to look at what replaced monarchy. And it seems to me what remains to be debated and discussed is, was the erosion of the divine right of kings and monarchs, was that replaced by a better system, which basically, like the deregulation of the African slave trade, led to the divine right of men, property of men, of European descent. And I'll leave that for your audience to decide. Second, it seems to me that, wittingly or not, defenders of the glorious uplifting U.S. narrative have stumbled into a moral dilemma. What I mean is that if you look at apartheid South Africa, apartheid South Africa was largely successful in assimilating European migrants from Latvia, from Lithuania, from all over Europe. Would you be able to make the argument that that formed a template for the assimilation and uplifting of Africans, in which case Nelson Mandela was wasting his time by fighting apartheid? He should have let history work its magic, and ultimately he would have been assimilated too. That is to say that those who suggest that the liberty and justice that were initially accorded to some in the United States formed a template for the rest of us, in many ways they're eliding and ignoring a white supremacy. They're eliding and ignoring the horrible persecution of Africans and are assuming that that didn't exist, that these were just other kinds of human beings who could be assimilated like Lithuanians and Latvians in South Africa. And I don't think that withstands the giggle test, among other things.
So we're going to pick up another segment with Gerald Horn. We're going to pick up by jumping ahead a bit to the Civil War and some of the reasons why abolitionism starts to become a strong force in the industrial Northeast. Much of that industrial Northeast itself a product of the bounty that came from slave society in the first place. Now, so please join us on Reality Asserts Itself on the Real News Network.
Ni bunda,
ni bunda,
ni pele chose ne dure pas, les grands hommes aussi, qu'ils viennent de Durban ou du royaume aussi. Ce n'est pas un fait nouveau depuis l'époque du Messie. Les hommes trop lucides sont ciblés, génocide. Le système n'aime pas ceux qui ont un sixième sens, car ils sont supposés avoir un troisième œil. On ne fera pas le deuil de ceux qui ont osé dire au péril de leur vie, refuser de mentir au nom de la dignité de la masse. Oppression des menaces, tenir le même discours, ça ne coupe pas les rues. Les hommes de cette carrure, ces hommes qui bravent tout sans armes et sans armure. Imagine la Turquie sans Ankara, ça en dit long, n'est-ce pas, je pense à Sankara. Les cerveaux du continent sont victimes de mascarades, victimes de balances qui s'en masquent. Sauvagement éliminé, l'Occident est tombé bas. Mais Patrice, ne t'en fais pas, l'Afrique ne t'oublie pas. Resteront éternels ceux qui mourront au combat. Indépendant comme le nom de son journal, il voulait qu'à son peuple il ne soit fait aucun mal. Norbert Zongo, c'est pour toi que ma plume vibre. Parti violemment pour avoir voulu une presse libre. Que vos âmes reposent en paix, que la terre vous soit légère. Contrairement à ce qu'il voulait, bourreau vous immortalise. On priera pour vous dans les mosquées, dans les églises. Je poursuis mon listing. Che Guevara, Gandhi, Luther King. Dans nos mémoires resteront toujours gravés comme Mandela, Malcolm X ou Marcus Garvey. À cette allure, le continent ne peut que sombrer, car ses militants sont tous en train de crever.
Yamlogaduni.
Oh,
flow combat. Be I born that features storm that reformat the masses. I'm redrafting the battle map set. Top of task list. I build a classic boom bap blast. Bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin. Attack with wind at the back. Plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs. I got passion. Burn mics up to ashes. I make fascists craft in pantsers. Stanzas cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance. Burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math. Distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard. Give back like church hats to get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick throw. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off. Switch shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap, boom bap, original rap at take it back. Boom bap, boom bap,
boom bap, original rap.
I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
Boom bap, original rap.
Well, sisters and brothers, I've decided that there's white trash in this country. But don't look among the rural poor or Appalachia to find them. The real white trash is in the corporate boardrooms, the governor's mansion, the courthouses, the national media. If you work for or ally yourselves with the high place vipers and hypocrites and thieves and polluters and repressors and assassins, you are trash. I am sick of these so-called leaders who are leading us to the slaughter. I'm sick of their blow-dry hairdos, their sleek, beefy, money-fed smiles, their pinstripe suits, and their tight-ass struts down the corridors of power. I'm sick of the sight of them, and I hate them with all the passion of my humanity, and don't anybody tell me to feel otherwise.
You're listening to CFIU.
Global Youth Network is a nonprofit grassroots organization that aims towards empowering youth through our trips abroad. Our trips are the least expensive way of traveling on campus and focus on bottom-up initiatives. Rather than going abroad with the intention of building something physical, like a school or a house or a well, we go abroad with the intention of building relationships with our contacts. In just a few months, you could be working with amazing people at a women's empowerment program in Kenya, on agricultural programs and a malaria clinic in a secluded area of northern India, or in a medical facility and school in rural Cambodia. All the while learning about healthcare, economics, culture, and education, while developing your own skills and learning about yourself. All three of our trips run throughout the entire month of May and are very meaningful and sustainable opportunities. Please email gyninfo@uoguelph.ca to learn more.
Are you drawn to aggressive sounds? Are you subject to violent outbursts of rage? Do you have sudden urges to destroy everything in sight? If so, we have just the thing for you.
Forever Death!
Forever Death on 93.3 CFRU, Thursday nights at 10 after 10, following the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
The Guelph Food Bank is looking for volunteers to help out throughout the year with various events and food drives. As a volunteer, you can help out with the warehouse, stuff a vehicle events, Christmas gift wrapping at the mall, and much, much more. The Guelph Food Bank is located at 100 Crimea Street in Guelph, a physically accessible location. For more information, contact Tracy at 519-767-1380.